You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show. Today with special guest host, Zane Velji.
What's going on, Canada? Zane Velji here. How are you doing? Has it hit you yet? Has the giant thump that is this federal election and all the election coverage crescendoing into this weekend hit you? Well, if it hasn't, you're welcome, because you've got this show today. We're going to talk a lot of politics today, and why not? So much stuff to talk about with the War Room will, of course, be joining us. I, of course, a standard fixture of the War Room, now taking the seat for one Evan Solomon, who is away today. So we'll have a special guest on the War Room as we talk about the end game of this campaign. The short strokes, as we say, the get out the vote. And you see a sense of desperation, as we talked about yesterday. You see a sense of elation from some campaigns, and you see some luminaries hitting the political trails. We'll talk about that, specifically related to Krychan and Mulroney. Blast from the past. Hitting up 90s politics in a real way. 80s and 90s politics. We'll talk about that with our War Room. We also got Scott Reed, overhyped, underplayed. So much going on. Where to focus your attention? What strategies matter? What voters are feeling? What voters are doing? We'll also talk to Shachi Kroll about that, president of the Angus Reid Institute. Some new numbers that they have. What does the final day stretch look like? What are the campaigns doing right now? Where are their seats to be gained? Where is their opportunity? So much stuff as we hit you with the politics straight into the bloodstream, as I like to say. It's going to be fun. We're going to have a great show on all things politics. But I need to start here in Alberta, where I come to you from. You know, if you've heard the show before and heard me replace Evan before, you know I have a huge soft spot for my province. I defend it at every turn. I love this place. I've lived here my whole life. This place means a lot to me. But looking at what's happening now in Alberta, and let me divorce the politics for a second. Regardless of what political jersey color you wear, it is heartbreaking to see what's happening here. We are an international shame. Articles in the New York Times, The Guardian, Washington Post, not talking about the fact that we've got the youngest, most vibrant demographics in the world, no. Not talking about the fact that we have new public institutions like the beautiful library in Calgary and Edmonton, that there's a sense of hope and resiliency, that there's an emerging tech center. No, that's not what these headlines are about. The headlines are about the unmitigated disaster that is our COVID response here in Alberta. And we have gone from a position of having our premier, Jason Kenney, declare that we're entering the greatest summer ever on July 1st, to now being on the doorstep, right there, opening the door to entering a fall from hell. Alberta had 1,600 COVID cases yesterday and 24 deaths. The majority of deaths in this country yesterday from COVID came here in Alberta. Why? Because we've entered, according to the premier, up until yesterday, the endemic state. We were going to live with COVID. I talked to you about it on this show. Many of you agreed that this is what Alberta needed to do, but we were going to live with COVID. We were not going to track any of our cases. We were not going to require people to isolate. We were not only rejecting vaccine passports here, we had a provincial government, a UCP, a party that has been fundraising on its opposition to vaccine passports. And where do we find ourselves? The highest number of cases, the greatest amount of deaths, and the least vaccinated population in the entire country, and an ICU that is bursting at the seams. And where have we ended up? We've ended up in a place where Jason Kenney stood at a podium yesterday and announced, amongst several things, a vaccine passport, a half-measure vaccine passport. Here's what he had to say.
The government has reluctantly decided to adopt the restriction exemption program, a proof of vaccination program for participation in certain discretionary activities that have a higher risk of viral transmission.
Did you hear the word vaccine passport? Because I didn't. No, it's because we don't really have one. What we do have is a restriction exemption opt-in system for businesses. As Jason Kenney continues to play politics here, we now have in this province a response to our increasing hospitalizations, ICUs, that is not just only inept, but it tries to balance a political division that doesn't exist. The majority of this province is vaccinated, 70%+. The vast majority of this province, nearly 80%, wants a mandatory vaccine passport. So what is the province that has these harrowing numbers do? They put the pressure on businesses to opt in to a voluntary exemption. If you opt in, you can operate if people that are either vaccinated or have a negative COVID test show up to your business. If not, we impose these stage one style restrictions on you. This is insanity. And don't just hear it from me. Here's what Calgary's Mayor Nahid Nenshi had to say about it.
I don't know how to feel. I'm mad. I'm sad. I'm disappointed. I have a little bit of better late than never, but I can't shake the feeling that it didn't have to be this way.
It didn't. And this is where we find ourselves, a premier that is literally torching his premiership to own the libs. He's trying to win an ideological war, balance a caucus, balance a far right and a more centrist universe within his caucus for his own good and for no one else's. And simultaneously, let's not forget, I said this show is all about politics. Well, let me get into it. He's screwing over his political cousin and Aaron O'Toole. Here's what O'Toole had to say when asked about Jason Kenney and the vaccines today.
We need to learn the lessons of each wave of the pandemic. And the best contact tracing efforts in our country in the first wave were in Alberta. Do you remember the contact tracing app that Justin Trudeau promoted? How has that gone? It's another example of everything he promised on his doorstep. He failed to deliver.
So O'Toole's stuck. He's in a box. Jason Kenney has proposed an inept structure for us here in Alberta. And let me quickly, before we hit the break, give you the pattern of what is going to happen here. Because this is all about politics. Kenny comes in and has always introduced these measures that are too little, too late. And then we see a second step, which I'll skip for a second, because I want to go to the third step, which is I suspect this province, when it's too little, when it's too late, when we have too many people dying, an additional how many, Jason Kenny? Dozen? Two dozen? Three dozen? Will that do it for you? You'll eventually get there 2 months late. But here's the big point. Step number two that I skipped over. There is going to be a caucus revolt. And if that doesn't happen within the confines of Jason Kenney's UCP, it will certainly play itself out on the federal election trail. Because not only has he screwed his political cousin in Aaron O'Toole, he's really screwed himself. We're hearing rumors that it's only days, if not weeks, for Jason Kenney. And while he's delayed, while he's dithered, while he's been absent, he hasn't just been absent from the federal campaign. He's been absent from his own province. And while he's trying to play a balancing act, he's fallen in the polls and he's lost all credibility. Later in the show, I'm going to talk to Dr. Joe Vipond about this, the situation in Alberta. If you hear my voice cracking, if you hear me angry, well, it's because I am. It didn't need to be this way. While it's all political for Jason Kenney, it's all about our lives. It's all about our livelihoods, the rest of us that live here. Shachi Curl next. We'll talk about the polling. Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon.
Evan Solomon is away. Sitting in, it's Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
What's going on, Canada? Zane Velji here. Hope you are doing well. Hope you're having a great Thursday. I mean, why wouldn't you? It's all politics all the time here. You know, this is what us political folks call the end game, the final steps, the short strokes. I always call this Bambi on ice, period, for all the politicians and all the ridings. They don't want to make any mistakes. They want to try to play it safe. But then there's always going to be one or two that need to throw a Hail Mary attempt. They need to make big gains. They're going to throw out the kitchen sink. Why? Because they either are desperate or they feel like it's just what they need to do. They throw out the playbook. And I love talking to folks that have a great insight into what these endgame periods look like. So I'm joined by none other than Shachi Kirl, president of the Angus Reid Institute. We're going to talk about some numbers, the state of the race. Shachi, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good. Listen, so, you know, these end games that we talk about in politics, the final stretches, from your perspective, what are you looking at and what are you seeing the race shaping up in these final days, these final 4 days of this election?
Well, look, first of all, everyone watching this race is looking for not just the numbers that have come out this week, but really this is prime time for being back in field, really understanding a couple of There's three key factors or elements now. First of all, turnout. I'll say it again, turnout, turnout, turnout. We are in the middle of a pandemic still. Mail-in ballot uptake was not what Elections Canada was perhaps predicting or expecting. Yeah. They had talked about being ready for 3 to 5 million ballots. I think only about 1 million have been requested. So that really speaks to, well, if there's big lineups on Monday, will people want to stick around for that? Will they feel safe in that, depending on what region they're in and what the situation is around outbreaks and infection spread? Or will they bail? Are you going to see really hardcore motivated voters coming out who tend to be older, more traditional voters who just come out every election? Or are you going to see young people feeling very, very motivated? And will that make a difference around issues such as climate change, which have them very galvanized by? And then, of course, there's also just a factor around enthusiasm. So now this is the second election in 2 years. We know from periods of time in Canadian history that are similar to this, that the more elections you have squeezed tighter together, it does have a depressing or dragging effect on overall turnout. So remember the Martin Harper years, 2004, 2006, 2008, 2011. Those were elections over a period of time in 7 years, four elections that really towards the end saw some low troughs in terms of voter turnout. So what's this going to look like? Where we are at right now, midweek, is a place where, heading towards the end of the week, is a place where the numbers overall look a heck of a lot like they did in 2019. So, you know, what is going to come of the big gamble on part of the Liberals to have gone for a majority, to have sought a mandate? Will they get the mandate they were looking for? Or is this, Zane, as I tend to call it, the West Wing election? There is a legendary episode of the West Wing where it's a midterm election. Bartlett's people, you know, go out, kill themselves, campaign really, really hard. And at the end of the night, you see, Josh sitting on the steps of his D.C. brownstone with his head in his hands because the numbers and the overall outcome hasn't moved at all. So, you know, these are the things we're watching for. Two other really important factors. What happens, as always, with the left of center vote? In 2015 and in 2019, they both coalesced around the Liberals and voted strategically rather than voting with their hearts. Might have wanted to have voted for Jagmeet Singh or at the time Tom Mulcair, but instead chose the Liberals. In this election, what happens? Do you see that tightening up, that strategic decision? Or do you see people say, you know what, three times is three times too many. This time we're going to vote our heart. On the other side, you're starting to see the People's Party popping up into the, you know, higher single digits.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And does that create any dynamics, particularly in Ontario and the Golden Horseshoe, with Conservative voters who may be peeling off to the PPC. And do they come back to the Conservatives because they want to stop the Liberals, or do they vote their conscience? So what happens literally on the ends of the political spectrum may well be a big part of the story.
Shasha, you should know that any West Wing reference is a gateway to my happy place. So now I am like more jazzed than I was before this conversation started. But let me throw in another West Wing reference, right? You know, the one element of political mythology that we've heard in this country is conservatives have a turnout advantage. And, you know, when we look back to a West Wing reference final season, Josh trying to get out the vote for Santos, redeploying resources to try to, you know, come across some of these myths of conservatives voting early, having a great ground game. It seems to be mythology across the continent. Have we seen that in Canada? And do you feel like that's an advantage here when we see these poll numbers? Do they factor in for this, whether it's true or mythologized, GOTV advantage that conservatives seem to have with their ground game strength?
So it's a good question. I would never underestimate the ground games of the Liberal vote. The ground game of the Liberal vote is what saved the Liberals, particularly in British Columbia in 2019. But what we are noting and what other pollsters are noting are really what I would call an enthusiasm gap for the Liberals right now. So maybe they are in the process of making that up. Maybe they're right in the process of really whipping that back up. But when you look at leader momentum, leader approval, and the desire to vote for a party rather than kick a party out, those indicators, all of those numbers do point to people feeling at this stage more motivated to see the Liberals off, so to speak, among the Conservative base. Whereas among Liberals, you know, you've got folks who I think are saying, look, this is perhaps the best choice others, but it's not something we feel as passionate about as we did in previous elections. So how that plays out, along with efficiency of vote, the Liberals have always had a very good efficiency of vote in that they've been able to pick up support everywhere they need it, when they need it. That saved them the last two times. Let's see what happens this time, because ultimately, this election and one of the most fundamental questions about it has been, why were we having it? And I think that may well be one of the deciding factors in the minds of many Canadians. But there are others. There's pandemic management. There's climate change. So, you know, let's see where those things land. But heading into this, if Justin Trudeau was looking for a comfortable majority, it's going to be a very interesting ride between now and Monday to see how that political math and how that campaign gets there. But that's why campaigns are crazy and anything is possible.
Yeah, sure. Seems like it, you know, especially if, you know, if Trudeau ends up with that minority, which is, seems to be one of the plausible outcomes out of Monday. What does that do? I mean, the story is still to be written there on after in terms of what does that do to legacy, leadership, et cetera. But Shachi, you know, with the less than minute I have with you, what metric or stat or top line number perhaps are you looking at as you head into this final weekend from your pollster perspective? Is there a crystallizing factor or metric that you feel like is going to be perhaps indicative of what we might see Monday night?
I do think turnout. We've talked about that a little bit,
yeah.
Shane. So I think turnout's going to be a big one. I think another big one will really have to be that level of enthusiasm. So not just how many people are showing up, but who's showing up and who's feeling enthusiastic and who's feeling like, well, I was going to vote, but then I looked and it was a 5-hour lineup and not everyone
right.
is masked or not, you know, I just don't feel comfortable around it. And I'm bailing, you know, that may play a role, but let's not underestimate either any of the major parties' abilities to deliver their vote. So this is an unprecedented election, no doubt about it.
Shachi Krill, president of the Angus Reid Institute. Shachi, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. On the other
Thanks,
side
thanks.
Of the break, I'm going to talk to emergency doc, Dr. Joe Vipond. He's going to tell me about what's going on in my home province here in Alberta. Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon. We'll be right back.
The Evan Solomon Show continues with special guest host Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hey, what's going on, Canada? Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon. Hope you're having a great Thursday wherever you are in this country. I'm spending a disproportionate amount of time on my home province, not because I'm self-centered or feel like we need to spend a large amount of time here in Alberta. I wish we weren't. Let me be totally clear. I wish we weren't spending this time on my province. But as I mentioned off the top, we are now an international laughingstock here in Alberta. With so much great that's going on here, this is what we're making headlines for, our inept COVID response. And after weeks of not being seen, after months of inaction, after months of gaslighting the Canadian or the Alberta public and certainly Canada as a whole, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney yesterday announced his province will enter a state of public emergency. Here's what he had to say.
Today, the government has declared a state of public health emergency.
And it's the third time he declared that state of emergency since the pandemic began. Every single one of us yesterday got that buzz on our cell phone and our smartwatch and our iPad. And here's what he had to say as that state of emergency was declared.
I know that we had all hoped this summer that we could put COVID behind us once and for all. That was certainly my hope, and I said so very clearly. It is now clear that we were wrong, and for that, I apologize.
So he apologizes, but then he says his government was wrong to moving in the endemic stage. But here's what he had to say later on regarding lifting those health protections.
And so, I don't apologize for the decision to relax public health restrictions in the summer, supported by the data, when numbers were declining and vaccine numbers were going up.
I just don't get it. I mean, I get it because I live here and I understand the political MO of my premier. But I just don't get it. What war is he trying to win? Because it clearly isn't the one against COVID. If it's to own the libs, well, congratulations, Mr. Kenny, you've done it. Now move on and do your job. You know, I want to bring someone else in to maybe add some perspective, add some depth to the conversation, because I'll keep ranting here. Dr. Joe Vipon, emergency doctor in Calgary and co-founder of Masks for Canada and Protect Our Province, Alberta. I will say he's been a profound champion of the health and the well-being of Albertans, tremendous advocate. Joe is what I call you, but Dr. Vipon, welcome to the show.
It's so great to be here, but I'm really concerned it's going to be co-ranting instead of just stopping ranting. So just be warned.
So maybe how about I do this? Let's get to the rants at the end, but how about I get something from you before that, which is not only are you a tremendous advocate, but you actually are an emergency doc. You are on the front lines of this thing, and you're on the front lines of this thing now. Tell me what you're seeing from the perspective of inside the hospital. And then maybe also tell me what you're seeing from the perspective of literally outside of one's hospital, where we're now seeing these mounting protests build as well. Tell me what you're seeing and frankly how that's making you and your colleagues feel within the already stressed out healthcare system in Alberta.
Yeah, this is the classic media question. What's it like on the ground? And unfortunately, yeah. I don't have a great answer for that, because when I see patients, like the vast majority of my patients are chest pain and abdominal pain and appendicitis and bladder infections, it's not all that exciting, because that's the bread and butter of the work that goes on, COVID notwithstanding. Really what we need to do in order to understand the COVID situation in the province is look at the numbers. And right now it's the hospitalizations and ICUs that are the big frontline story. You know, we're at 218 admissions in the ICU with a doubling time of 15 days. It doesn't take much math to understand that means by the end of the month we'll be over 400 ICU cases, and we're struggling as it is at 218. So I'm not exactly sure how we're going to get out of this. It's not going to be with just transferring people out of province. The other two provinces adjacent to us are in equal dire straits, BC and Saskatchewan. And so I'm worried we're going to be instituting this triage protocol that was mentioned yesterday, which essentially means we're going to be allowing people to die that otherwise would have lived. This is a profoundly morally distressing situation to put our healthcare workers in. So that's the situation, maybe not on the ground, but in my mind.
Well, no, this is helpful because, you know, I ask you from a question from a perspective of someone who's obviously works with patients day to day at a high volume, but your answer about triage is just startling. It's you said, you know, morally, not just, you know, it's questionable, but it's just morally bankrupt in many ways. We haven't seen this in a very long time. I will acknowledge this is not where Alberta is, but this is where we're headed if these restrictions don't work. And maybe I'll jump in to that conversation with you, Dr. Vipond. What do you think about these new quote-unquote restrictions, this exemption program in Alberta? Will this work? Will this do what it needs to do, to your earlier point about the numbers in our province?
So we're dealing with exponential growth, which means that cases are rising day over day over the past, you know, the past week. It means that what I think in looking at these restrictions is that we'll be slowing that exponential growth, but we will not be causing it to start to drop. Exponential decay is powerful when you have really good restrictions, and we saw that in the spring, in the third wave, when we actually had some reasonable restrictions and how fast things dropped. But there are big, big gaps in these restrictions, and the biggest probably being not doing enough for schools. And I think because of that, we're ultimately setting ourselves up to fail.
You know, one of the other reasons we might be setting ourselves up to fail is that this never needed to happen. This endemic stage entering never needed to happen. I think to anyone taking a victory lap here from the pure politics of being right, that's not what we need. And I'm not saying that that's the narrative we're seeing, but we are seeing some of it on Twitter and social media after, you know, Kenny had to reverse course and then do his sorry but not sorry little tour yesterday. From your perspective, however, do you feel like, you know, we are entering a stage where the past actions, the entering of the endemic stage, is what has caused this exponential growth and is perhaps what set the trajectory here? And what is needed to perhaps get us to that point where you talk about exponential growth, curbing that in a meaningful way?
Okay, so there's a lot there, Zane, so bear me out. The first thing is we talked about the moral distress of dealing with these preventable deaths. And just throw on the fact that these are preventable purely because of political machinations and dogma. We had people yelling from the rooftops for the last 6 weeks that things needed to change. I started yelling from the rooftop 2 days after Stampede because that's when the first hints of exponential growth were starting. And the thing with exponential growth is you deal with it early and hard, and then you don't have to do big restrictions. Probably the biggest gaslighting in yesterday's event was this statement that advocates, which I think he actually meant myself and the group that I work with, are asking for permanent restrictions, which is absolutely not true. We want Atlantic Canada style policy management, which means when you start to see that exponential growth, you put in those restrictions, you get it back down to as close to zero as possible, and then you reopen so that you're freer. If you asked a citizen of Nova Scotia if they would pick their lifestyle over Albertans' lifestyle with the roller coaster of, you know, near lockdowns and then reopening to freedoms, I guarantee you that the Nova Scotia citizen would say, hey, I'll just stay right here, thanks. So what needs to happen? Well, I think there's three truisms about COVID that our government's not acknowledging. And until we actually deal with those three things, we're not going to win. The first is asymptomatic spread. So we know from studies that over 50% of transmission occurs with people in an asymptomatic state. And what does that mean? It means we really need to do good contact tracing because we really need to be isolating close contacts and testing close contacts. So we've removed asymptomatic testing and we've removed the self-isolation requirement of close contacts. And I didn't hear a peep about that in yesterday's announcement.
I've got about 30 seconds for it, just so you know.
Sorry. Second thing is airborne transmission, really important. And the third thing is schools or nidus of infection. And we're just letting it run rampant still in schools. There, less than 30 seconds.
Look at you, Dr. Joe Vipond. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for the conversation. So much to be seen in terms of what happens in Alberta. I outlined what the stages are. We're going to see a caucus revolt before this. On the other side, a new way to get paid. I'll talk to you about it next.
You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show, today with special guest host Zane Velji.
What's going on, Canada? Zane Velji sitting in for Evan Solomon. I hope you're having a great Thursday. That's a fun show. You know, it's fun because we got to talk politics. And yes, it's been a little dark with my situation in Alberta, but here's something I want to pose at you. I'm really excited for this topic. I'm really excited about this topic for a couple of reasons, because it actually ties into the politics of the day. You know, we've been talking about inflation, the big I word. Well, here's the thing. Inflation is very much a fancy way of saying how much you got to pay for stuff. It's more. You're having to pay more now for groceries, for gas, for your housing, for heating. The list goes on and on. And so the question is, should we be changing the way we get paid? You know, a new poll that's out in Forbes says that most workers want to be paid automatically every day. You know that two-week increment that most of us do, that our parents did and our grandparents did, and if you're in this country for longer than that your great-grandparents did, you got that check every 2 weeks? Well, are times a-changing? Should they change? I want to hear from you. Give me a call, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. The question is very simple. Would you rather be paid every day? Are you good with the system we have now, every 2 weeks or in some cases every month? Are you part of this 83% that wants to get paid daily? Yep, that's good. Give me my $119 every single day, deposit it directly. And are you a small business owner, for example, or someone who has to pay people who says, whoa, I can't do this. This would be crazy for my cash flow, for my business. This can't be a trend that takes hold. Give me a call, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. Would you rather be paid every day? And I'm going to spend a bit of time walking you through this poll a bit. It says 83% of workers believe they should have access to their earned wages at the end of each workday or shift. They're comparing this to how someone might get a paint job on a day or mow someone's lawn. You know, those people get paid every day. If you got someone babysitting your kids, they're probably getting paid every single day. Should we, as workers who are on a two-week cycle, be now part of the everyday universe? 80% would prefer to have their pay automatically. 78% said free access to on-demand pay would give more loyalty to their employer. 81% said they would take a job with an employer that provides access to earned wages at the end of the day. What do you want to do? 1-855-633-1010 or text me 71010. Do you want to get paid every day? Do you want to get paid your daily earnings for that labor you put in that day? Boom, 5 p.m. in your bank account. Are you good with the current system? Does it help you budget? Or are you an employer and you're saying, no way is this possible? I want to take a call here. John from Niagara. John, lay it on me. What do you think? You want to get paid every day?
I wouldn't mind that for sure if it could be done. I think a lot of employers are going to have to be slow and easy getting into this system, but I think with the financial system the way it is, computerized payments and Interact and TAP and all that other stuff, that good stuff that's out there, it can be done. Maybe they could start out, employers could start out by paying someone overtime if they work a day of overtime, for example, and they say, okay, you can get paid on a daily basis if you work this overtime shift, but we'll have to gradually put this in every 2 weeks that you'll get your primary pay. On a two-week pay period, but the overtime, maybe they could start out that way and say, okay, if you're working to stay overtime, we'll pay you out after the day's done. I think it's very, very possible. And if it can be done, it should be.
Thanks, John, for the call. I appreciate it. Very thoughtful call. Very thoughtful response. Getting a lot of texts here. Seems like this is a very divisive conversation. I like it. Before I jump into the text, I want to take Doug. Doug, you're in Kitchener. What do you think? Do you want to get paid every day? Should we societally implement this as a new structure to get paid every single day?
Who's going to incur the cost to the employer to do a payroll every day? Somebody's on shift now. Somebody works 5 hours. Somebody works 6 hours. Somebody's on, let's say, it's complete stupidity.
I appreciate the call, Doug. Thank you. You're breaking up there, but I got your point. You're not for it. How's it going to work logistically? And listen, Doug, you're in good company. Oh, you are in very good company. A lot of people agreeing with you. I'm a small business owner. Here's a text I'm reading. I'm a small business owner, and as a small business in construction, I don't get paid every day. I might get paid every 6 months or every 7 months for some jobs. I still need to dish out for labor and material costs. The implication here, how do you pay others if you're only getting paid every 6 months? Some people say daily pay would not change anything for me. Absolutely not. Another text coming in here. People need to learn to budget. That's a really interesting point, because the two-week pay cycle is not just about how we receive money, but for many of us, it's for how we budget. It's how we kind of make our household budget, figure out what we're going to buy when, not overspend, not try to, spend more than we earn. But a lot of support as well. If I can pay my bills and have it received online in minutes, there's no reason we can't get paid daily. Another text you're saying, I think people will be in more debt if they get paid every day. Another text you're saying, getting paid every day would be like payday loans. People would spend the money and have nothing left for the essentials, for rent, etc. That one coming to us from James. Give me a quick call if you have an opinion on this, 1-855-633-1010, or text me. Keep the text coming at 71010. Should we get paid every single day rather than the two-week or monthly schedule that we're on? Getting another one saying that this is ridiculous, a manifestation of a Gen Z idea. I don't know if I can argue with you on that last point. It does seem to be something more generationally popular, something to do with justice, something to do with, you know, the fact that folks want their income in front of them every single day. Getting a lot of other texts here. Let me read one here. How about bills come out every day as well? That's a pretty funny text. I like that one. I've been paid daily. Here's someone who's been paid daily, Jamila, biweekly and monthly, and honestly saved way more money when I was paid because it was forced me to manage my money well. Tom, in Montreal, I got 30 seconds for you. Lay it on me. Should we be getting paid every day?
You're going to pay every day?
Yes. I got 30 seconds for you, Tom.
Much more taxes, and not only that, they should get paid in a different way. They should get paid because if companies go bankrupt, the first one that gets paid is the bank. It should not be the bank. It should be guaranteed the employees first.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Tom. Tom's saying higher taxes. Tom also bringing in that argument about justice, of saying the employees who've kind of given their labor deserve to get paid first. Getting another text here saying all accountants and people doing payroll would hate their life if that happened. You know, from my perspective, I think this could be something. I think for certain companies, they're going to use this as a carrot. You know, we've heard the term carrot and stick a lot. I think certain companies are going to use this as a carrot to retain employees, to grab employees, to say we're a company that believes in just payment system, et cetera. Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun to see what happens. On the other side of the break, I'm talking to my pals in the war room. We're going to talk all things politic. Tom Mulcair, Tasha Carradine. Got a special guest. See you on the other side. Zane Belge, filling in for Evan Solomon.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show, today with special guest host Zane Velji.
What's going on, Canada? You know, one of the secrets of radio is that when the regular host leaves, he or she actually leaves you their shoes. And while Evan is a tall and very handsome man, I have to tell you this, probably wouldn't want me to tell you this, very small shoes he's left me, tiny shoes, in other ways, very, very small shoes to fill for me. So let me put on those tiny shoes and walk right in to the war room.
Let me be perfectly clear.
Putting out misinformation.
And we hear them.
Misleading politics.
What's really important here.
Spreading it online.
Unequivocally.
The war room.
I like that. I like that more than anyone else did. But you know what? I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that. Tom Mulcair, CTV political analyst and former NDP leader. Tasha Carradine, a principal with Navigator and national political columnist for Post Media. And Susan Smith, principal at Blue Sky Strategy Group. Hello, friends. How's it going?
Hey, Zane.
Hey, well, listen, how are you feeling?
Well, listen, I feel great because while Evan has also left me his shoes, he's also left me his book of dad jokes, which I'm not going to crack open. I know he uses it too heavily. But how is this for transition material? Tasha, I'm going to start with you. Speaking of dad jokes, Aaron O'Toole is saying that the Conservative Party is not your father's Conservative Party anymore. He starts the day saying that. He ends the day campaigning with someone whose dad probably voted for the conservative leader at that time, Brian Mulroney. What do you think of this positioning, Tasha, for Aaron O'Toole in this endgame of really trying to own the PC stripes in these final days?
Well, you know, I mean, Justin Trudeau trotted out John Chrétien the day before. This isn't an unheard of thing. Past leaders tend to make appearances in campaigns, especially in this campaign where things are so tight. And I mean, Brian Mulroney is incredibly popular, particularly in Quebec still. And with the older members of the party, some like me who remember him when I was a member of the party, that is, back in the day, that he was, you know, a very well-regarded leader and former leader now. So I think that's where that came from. I mean, some people would say that, you know, you would want it to be your father's party because back then it was the Progressive Conservative Party. So
sure.
I'm not sure what father's party O'Toole was alluding to, which father he was, you know, was Stephen Harper or was it Brian Mulroney? Anyway, I think that honestly, it's just what campaigns do. I don't read a lot into it.
Tom, you know, I've had a blanket rule. For me, I've just said influencers, regardless of whether they're past PMs or celebrities or whatnot, they just don't work. I think people see right through that strategy of someone being coerced to show up on stage. Am I wrong? Or do you feel like what you've seen with both perhaps Chrétien and Mulroney could pay dividends for the two front runners in this campaign?
Well, then there's Hazel McCallion, the former longtime mayor of
Mississauga. She undermined her endorsement anyway, to be honest.
She's a real influencer. Look, Trudeau just got a nice letter from Barack Obama. I mean, you know, it could be better than that. Quick quiz question. Which candidate got an endorsement from Jane Fonda on the first day? Avi Lewis, running for the NDP out in British Columbia. So it's all part of the game. I'm not 100% sure, though. It works well. Talking about endorsements, a week ago today, François Legault pretty well openly endorsed Aaron O'Toole. And then all hell broke loose on the English debate with the first question. And the rest, as they say, is history. So you're never too sure how it's going to turn out. Legault's endorsement doesn't mean a heck of a lot right now because everybody turned back towards the Bloc here in Quebec. With regard to Barack Obama, I mean, you know, he says, you know, great for democracy, but that just reminds progressives that the biggest broken promise of Justin Trudeau was on democratic reform. So, I'm not 100% sure that having people from the outside, especially in America, no matter how well he was respected on the world stage, is going to help Mr. Trudeau or anybody else at this point.
Some of us were concerned, by the way, Tom, that the Barack Obama-Justin Trudeau bromance would not continue, would not find itself another chapter. But worry not, Canada. A tweet has been sent from one Barack Obama. Susan, you know, talk to me about this positioning by O'Toole in the endgame, because I find it fascinating, because one of the things I've been saying, and perhaps too simplistically, is that our political spectrum, and maybe this election has showcased it, is starting to move to the left, right? Where you have, you know, Jagmeet Singh clearly competing for traditional NDP territory. You got Justin Trudeau marching further left than a Liberal government has in recent memory. And then you now have O'Toole kind of saying, oh, is there some lost Liberal terrain here that I can find? What do you think of his positioning of the going from true blue in the leadership to outflanking McKay to now owning what I would say is former Liberal turf in some ways?
Well, a couple things. I think Canadians largely hang out around the center, though for Mr. O'Toole, this is a bit of dangerous territory for him, precisely the way you pointed it out. He campaigned for the leadership as a true blue conservative. That's, you know, he was in Stephen Harper's cabinet. That's who he purported to represent, remember, against the progressive Peter McKay. And now he's trotting out Brian Mulroney and he's trying to show that he's got a bigger tent. This is risky for him, especially with the rise, sadly, of Max Bernier. And while I like you know, I'm a blue liberal, so I prefer to hang out in the middle of the spectrum on things.
Right,
I don't
right.
think he's really going to convince blue liberals or soft liberals to come over to him in this particular case, simply because he's flip-flopped around so much and on issues that are key for people like climate change, like I wouldn't say gun control is a key issue, but it's an example of his leadership, and the vaccine question. Those are things that he's trying to keep in the right wing of the party while at the same time trying to bring in the progressive side. In the end, I do think this election will be about a progressive vote versus the conservative vote. And it'll be interesting to see how it splits. But I think this tactic of Mr. O'Toole, as Mr. Krejci said, Mr. Krejci cracked a joke this week and he said, Aaron O'Toole can do what I can't do, talk out of both sides of my mouth. Only Mr. Krejci can say yeah. that about himself. It was pretty funny, but I think in this case, it's true. Mr. O'Toole's trying to have it both ways.
You know, Tom,
I think that there's a point. Yeah. With regard to Susan's point, I think it's worth pointing out that anytime the Liberals tried to stick things to him, like right at the beginning, he's an anti-vaxxer, he's anti-choice, they threw the book at him and it didn't stick. But what happened was, as O'Toole made it quite clear that he was serious about dealing with climate change, even though his program, of course, is a little bit of fiction, but he talked about the guns. He was quite different from anything that the Conservatives had said before. So that was starting to bleed votes towards Maxime Bernier. We all see that in the polls. But at the same time, anytime the Liberals started trying to say, by the way, this guy's a right-wing crackpot, implicitly or explicitly, O'Toole or the people around him got to say, right-wing crackpot, oh, you must be talking about our friend Maxime Bernier, because that's where the crackpots go. They're with him, not with us. So trying to tie O'Toole to the anti-vaxxers at those crowds, which is something Mr. Trudeau did for about 5-6 days right at the beginning of those protests, they stopped doing that because it wasn't working. And it was clear that Maxime Bernier is the home for all of these right-wing lunatics.
You know, Tasha, I want to pick up on this from your perspective as someone who's kind of worn the conservative jersey. You know, from what you see, are you worried that this strategy could actually undermine the strategy of trying to move to PC, could undermine Aaron O'Toole and might actually lead to an election night loss where he perhaps took the bait and went too far left?
Well, he's damned if he does, and he's damned if he doesn't. This is the issue, is how do you stop that bleeding to the PPC of people who have grievances against, conservative, as they see conservative light or red Toryism or progressive conservatism, people who say, no, that's not my home. How do you say to them, and the only thing he's really been able to say is, if you split the vote, and there was, I saw something out today, Nick Kouvalis polling company saying, if you split the vote, if you go PPC, it's a vote for Trudeau. It's the same as saying a vote for Jagmeet Singh. It's a vote for Aaron O'Toole. Aaron O'Toole can say. He cannot appeal to the better angels of the people in the PPC because they want nothing to do with him. They have their own motivations for being over there. So it's very difficult. But yes, broadening the tent, you're going to lose people off the edges and the fringes, and that is a growing fringe. I do believe the PPC will be a spoiler in some ridings. Estimates ranging up to 10 ridings that they could spoil things for the Tories.
It's fascinating. And Tom, I'll pick it up with you after the break, because I want to talk about what the strategic implications for each of the leaders in the end games look like. We'll also talk about BIPOC cabinet representation, a question by CTV's Omar Sachedina posed to Justin Trudeau. Could be interesting. The War Room on the other side.
Filling in for Evan Solomon, here's Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Let me be perfectly clear.
Putting out misinformation.
And we hear them.
Misleading politics.
What's really important here.
Spreading it online.
Unequivocally.
The War Room.
Back with you, Zane Velji here. The War Room, also here with me, Susan Smith, principal at Blue Sky Strategy Group. Tasha Carradine, principal with Navigator Limited and a national political columnist for Post Media. And of course, Tom Mulcair, CTV political analyst and former NDP leader. Hello, friends, again. You know, here's where I want to pick it up. And no, the answer is not with Evan's dad jokes book, which I'm not picking up. But I want to talk about, I will refuse to. I would rather let the show be a total disaster than to even inflict one of those upon not just you, but the listening public. I won't do it, Evan. Here's what I want to pick up, though. And Susan, maybe I'll start with you on this. Is Liberal leader Justin Trudeau said he won't formally commit to a specific target for representation of Black, Indigenous, and people of color in cabinet. This, of course, despite doing so in 2015. Here's an interview clip with CTV National News' Omar Sachedina yesterday, in which Trudeau kind of responded to.
I commit to continuing to doing more. What we have done over the past years is bring in far more diversity into the Prime Minister's office than ever before, into cabinet. We're going to continue to make sure that we're the party that not just upholds diversity in Canada, but embodies it.
Susan, you know, as the leader who embraced the Black Lives Matter movement, who took that knee at the protests, who's clearly, you know, talking about reconciliation and wants to make it a priority. Should he have just said yes to that question to perhaps avoid the attacks of more symbolism than commitments in action?
Well, Omar asked him if he would commit to a 50% target. And the yep. lead up to that was he also said that, you know, 30% of the prime minister's staff right now identify as BIPOC. And it's obviously all in the context of 50% gender equity cabinet. You know what, Zane, I spoke to a friend. I'm a white woman. So I called up a friend who's in politics and who is a member of the BIPOC community. And I said, what do you think of this? And the person said to me, their response was, the prime minister has already had, he's walked the talk on the most diverse cabinet that the country has ever seen. The person said, I heard in their answer their continued commitment to that. And their belief was, when you have people around the table who have lived experiences, and you have a cabinet that looks like the Canadian population, and the prime minister has made a commitment to that, that person was comfortable with that answer. So I believe the prime minister when he says he wants to continue to have as much diversity as possible. I think hard numbers like that are sometimes difficult because the cabinet has to represent the country regionally from gender and from a, you know, an ethnic composition. So there are many things that go into cabinet making, and I believe Trudeau will always continue to look at all of those things when he does it.
You know, Tom, what I found interesting about the question, I'll get to the politics in a second, but I'll highlight this, was the ask for the commitment to Susan's point about 50%, not just for cabinet, but for the decision makers in the PMO. And as you know, as this panel certainly knows, that a lot of the decisions in this country are made by unelected political staff. So, Tom, when you heard that question from both a policy and, frankly, political perspective of what this could mean to the prime minister, where was your head at when you heard that question and, you know, Justin Trudeau's response?
Well, Omar Sachedina is in a good position to be asking that question, isn't he? Yeah. And, you know, he's fluently bilingual, but he's got his own background and he's probably had to navigate in a world that was mostly white when he came into it. He's been there for a few years now. But I think that Mr. Trudeau is trying to have it both ways because he has made that commitment in the past. It has been pointed out to him in previous interviews that there were really qualified Black people, for example, in his caucus. And just for the sake of it, BIPOC is a word that we keep using the acronym for, but for everybody listening, that's, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
Yep.
So Mr. Trudeau has made that commitment before, fallen short, had really good people who weren't being named. That was always a bit of a mystery to me. And I think that he could have done a lot more. Also, we've got out there right now, Jody Wilson-Raybould and Cesar Chavannes, out there, you know, banging the drum about their bad treatment at the hands of Justin Trudeau. So he does have a lot of explaining to do. Susan's right. You know, he can point to him, his cabinet and his staff as having been far more diverse than Stephen Harper's. But I'm not sure that that's the standard you want to be measured by.
You know, Tasha, from your perspective, as Trudeau tries to make the final sprint, I've saying, you know, to try to get those red-orange switchers, do you think a story like this or a response like this could be an added proof point to maybe, maybe not a holistic lack of commitment, but a lack of hard commitment on a topic that he clearly wants to be positioned as a champion on?
Well, it is interesting that he did, you know, set a target for women, a very clear target, and trumpeted it very, very loudly. He won't set one here. And, yeah, Cesar Chavanz is the woman, Selena Cesar Chavanz, immediately came to mind because, you know, she was in his cabinet. She is extremely talented. She's a black woman who's now actually campaigning for or endorsed the candidate, the conservative candidate in her riding. And was very ill-treated. And I think Trudeau has a sore point on this. And I think, yes, that is an issue that not just the NDP, but also the Green Party, Annamie Paul, you know, she raised it during the debate. She goes, you need more people like me up here. And she's her lived experience, too, as a woman of color who said, she brings that to the table in a way that Justin Trudeau obviously can't. But he has to have people like her around him to have him understand what the challenges that the community faces are. And I think that that's a bit of a blind spot that could be, I hate to say the word exploited, that's the wrong word to use, but
yeah,
that could be used by the other parties, the NDP and the Greens, to say, hey, you know, you walk the walk or you talk the talk, but you're not walking the walk. Come over here.
And I think that's one of the reasons why Singh is doing so well in the greater Toronto area, because that shared experience is something that he can talk to firsthand. Young kids coming out of university, top grades, but not being given the top jobs in the law firm or the accounting firm, that sort of thing. And Singh understands that. When he hopped up on stage at that, you know, it was a tragic event after the horrific Islamophobic terrorist murder of that family in London. Mr. Trudeau was there, Premier Ford was there. But it's when Jagmeet Singh got up on stage that you realize the depth of the appreciation that people have for him and for his understanding of the issues that are important to them.
I started off by saying that Mr. Trudeau has had the most diverse cabinet that this country has ever had. And you build your cabinet out of your caucus, you build your staff out of the people that come forward. And so I think we have to be careful not to dismiss people like Anita Anand, who is the woman that secured the vaccines for us as a country, or Ahmed Hussein, who came here as a Somali refugee and worked his way up to being a lawyer and all the way to elected official and into cabinet. There are many, many people like that in the government, like elected in our House of Commons, who are part of the Liberal caucus and part of the Liberal cabinet. And, you know, the Prime Minister's office itself, the number was there that Omar put out, 22% of the population identifies itself as BIPOC, 30% of the Prime Minister's staff identifies itself as BIPOC. This is something that we need to work on as a country on an ongoing basis. But Justin Trudeau has walked the talk. And you work with the people that are in front of you. Not everybody makes cabinet. It doesn't work that way.
I appreciate that. Yeah, no.
So I think we have to be careful in how we characterize this.
I appreciate that, Susan. I'm going to just jump in here because I want to get one more round of questions. Tasha, I'm going to start with you on this quickly. Do we have a ballot box question yet? This thing started as an affordability question and then a vaccine wedge election and then a health wedge. Is there something crystallizing in your mind that Canadians are going to vote for on Monday as we head into the weekend?
Oh, I think the overarching question that won't go away is, why are we in this election? I think that one is a ballot question for a lot of people, and it does not play in Mr. Trudeau's favor at all. There's also ballot questions for people who are, you know, the anti-vaccination crowd. They just look at this as a referendum on the size of government or the role of government. I think everyone's got kind of a different question, but the big one, I think, still is, why are we here? And that is going to be problematic for the Liberals if that, you know, if the more that one sticks with people.
Tom, I got 15 seconds, Tom. Do you want to lay on a ballot box question for me for Monday?
It's going to be easy. I agree completely with Tasha. Mr. Trudeau did this as a project for the Liberals and for himself, threw us into a $650 million needless election in the middle of the fourth wave of a pandemic. And he's going to pay a price for it at the polls.
Susan? Very quickly.
I think it's about health of Canada, COVID recovery, community recovery, child care, and the climate change.
Scott Reed on the other side. That was the War Room.
Evan Solomon is away. Sitting in, it's Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Overhyped. Create jobs and opportunity.
In this election,
here's what I want to do.
Or underplayed.
CTV News political commentator and former communications director for Prime Minister Paul Martin. the wonderful, the ubiquitous, the masculine Scott Reed. Hello, sir.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Not that I require any bolstering when it comes to that subject matter, but being reminded of my masculinity is always welcome. So thank you.
I'm reading from the script that was given to me, sir. So listen, this is what I was told is what you needed in the moment, and I'm glad to be there to deliver it to you. How you holding up? Before we get going, I understand you're ready to get chained to a desk Sunday and Monday to talk your head off. How are you holding up in prep for that? And how's this roller coaster been for you?
It's been a blast, man. You know, yeah. I love campaigns. Close campaigns are, you know, like chocolate pudding to me. I just can't get enough. So it's been a blast. And yeah, so we'll do the dress rehearsals and the blocking out on Sunday at CTV. We're going to be actually in a studio with other human beings. That's going to be fun. And then we have 233 hours of consecutive broadcast coverage on Monday evening.
Oh, well, it's going to be wonderful. We're all going to be watching. Scott, let's jump into it, because I won't be side by side with you on CTV. So I want to get your perspectives now. And, you know, let's start here. One of the big headline stories that I've spent a considerable amount of time talking about here on this show today has been Jason Kenney in Alberta. He's coming in with his vaccine passport, not so vaccine passport. He's coming with my apologize, but also screw you, Alberta. I don't apologize. Overhyped or underplayed the impact this will have to his political brethren, Aaron O'Toole and the Conservatives in the endgame?
I think we underhype it as significant as we have, you know, spoken about it in the last 24 hours, or it's not even 24 hours, 12 yeah. hours. But I think it's having a profound effect. I mean, I watched Aaron O'Toole's news conference today. He was asked over and over and over again, do you now agree with Jason Kenney the vaccine passports are necessary, or do you still disagree now, even with the Conservative Premier of Alberta, the vaccine mandatory vaccinations are not necessary? Do you now agree, because you once before said that Alberta was the model that all other jurisdictions should follow? Do you now agree that actually Justin Trudeau did a better job of managing the pandemic than Jason Kenney? And he just wouldn't answer those questions. That angered the media. And, you know, I think, you know, we've got a fourth wave. Alberta's obviously in real crisis. You know, people in Ontario, where I'm from, are looking at Alberta going, is that the ghost of Christmas yet to come for us? Like, yeah. How does this work? And, you know, to just sort of think, well, I'm going to stonewall my way through these questions. I think it could have a real effect. Now, the warning I'd say, though, for the Liberals is don't try to dunk this ball. You know, you cannot for a second look like you're celebrating this situation, that you're thrilled to see this crisis bring these issues into focus. And to be fair to the Prime Minister, I thought today when he began by saying that, you know, look, we're dumping every resource we can toward Alberta, speaking to Premier Kenney, doing everything possible. That's the right tone. You want to be very, very careful here. You do not want to look exploitative, because you know what? Actually, politics does come second. When 24 people die in a day, politics as to and should come second.
Yeah, it's a disaster here. You're absolutely right, as I speak to you from Calgary. And one of my biggest worries was exactly what you said, that Trudeau would be starry-eyed about it, would see this opportunity, would too aggressively shadow box. And let's be clear, he's done that. He's done all of those things in this election. He's been their attack dog, which I think is extremely strange in many ways this election. But I think that tone was struck quite well. My concern for the Liberals, though, is that it's you know, from a political perspective, it's probably too late, especially as O'Toole's starting to grab some of the middle. But I mean, all will be revealed, Scott, on Monday. Speaking of revelations and folks coming out to support, we're now seeing the influencer wars between the Conservatives and the Liberals. We got Chrétien, we got Mulroney. We just had a tweet from the broski Barack Obama. From your perspective, these influencers and endorsements, overhyped, underplayed?
Overhyped. I think significantly overhyped. I particularly think, as a matter of strategy, the idea that with 4 days to go, Aaron O'Toole,
what's on everyone's mind, exactly.
That Aaron O'Toole is going to persuade not his own party, but Canadians, that he's a moderate conservative, that the Harper years didn't exist. And then from, I guess, from his perspective, maybe ought not to have existed. It sounds
right.
Now they're aberrant, which I think is for sure going to anger people within his own party and constituency. But to say to Canadians, oh, see, I'm a progressive conservative. I'm a PC. I'm Mike Mulroney. I don't think that plays. I don't think that works. I have enormous respect for Prime Minister Mulroney. I really think he's a tremendous political leader, really like, I think as skilled a pure politician as we've ever seen. But you know, from my perspective, it's way overhyped. And Chrétien, it's great. Chrétien always makes liberals feel great. He comes out, he does the stuff, he says vive le Canada. I told Justin it was just like when I did it in 1968. I told Pierre and everybody laughs and everything's great and all that, right? Is it gonna really do anything? No, it pumps up liberals, which is swell, but it doesn't really move voters.
I don't even have to pay for the impersonation, Scott. That should be a subscription paywalled service that you provide. But there you go. You nailed it. And I didn't even have to ask for it. I love it. From the perspective of here's my thing about the endorsements. I think just the soak time isn't there like many things right now. And how will it actually make an impact for those that are undecided, to your point? And so I also, you know, earlier in the show talking to War Room, feel like this is massively overhyped. And just as a rule of principle, whether it's a celebrity or a former politician, it just doesn't work. But Scott, to this point about O'Toole, let me stick on that for a second. Overhyped or underplayed his strategy to kind of position himself as not your dad's conservative party. What do you think of that strategy in the end game here, when, you know, there is a right flank that's starting to galvanize, at least to some degree, to another option?
I really don't understand it. So I think it's underplayed. I think it's underappreciated as a bad strategy. And we'll find out. But I'd be willing to bet some serious money. I'd be willing to bet some Zane money, because I know you roll with the high rollers.
I roll with my own currency. It's true. Absolutely.
There you go. You've got the Zane. I want five Zanes. Five Zanes on this. I think that we could see the wheels start to wobble on this conservative campaign, because I think it's demotivating to conservatives who are part of the Harper years. To hear him say that was an aberration, let's look past that. And I don't think it's persuasive to Canadians. And what's the knock on O'Toole? The knock on O'Toole, and the Liberals got some traction on this. They put it into ads and they were saying it at the microphones. He'll say anything. He's about anything. This is the guy who ran to become leader by saying, I'm a true blue conservative, positioned himself to the right of Peter McKay. Now he's going to say, yeah, I got no truck and trade with those right wing guys. And it doesn't make any sense, because he is under massive pressure from the right. And I think they're going to play a big role. I think you're going to see in Southwestern Ontario that the People's Party are going to score some votes and affect some outcomes in ridings. I think maybe the same will happen in rural Quebec. And God only knows, you tell me. I mean, those people are going to be right off the leash in Alberta now after
last night's
announcement.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the pander fest to Quebec to begin with, but just him jumping in and being in the soup with Justin Trudeau on his contract with Quebec, it has been the galvanizing force here for the PPC and Maverick. Scott, I got 60 seconds left with you. One final one I want to throw at you. The mythology of the conservative parties get out the vote bump, that they kill at the ground game. This is their edge. Do you go add 2 points to the national polls for it? Overhyped, underplayed in your mind?
Overhyped. It's generally true, but again, it's because of that 10 to 20% of their base that is so hardcore. But some of that has been siphoned off to the People's Party. They may live to regret that phenomenon.
I love it. Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator, former communications director for Prime Minister Paul Martin. Scott, have a great election night. Thank you for all your coverage. You are indeed, as the script says, masculine. I need to make note of that you are indeed masculine, and I appreciate your masculine self being here.
When you come back from break, please explain to people why you're saying that. It just makes me feel uneasy.
I will.
Thanks, everybody. See you soon.
We'll 100% do it. Fred Fox, brother of Terry Fox, up next. Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon.
The Evan Solomon Show continues with special guest host Zane Velji on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hey, Canada, Zane Velji here. Hope you are doing well this Thursday. You know, we like to end the show off with either something lighthearted, something that kind of sets you off your way with inspiration, with a bit of momentum, with a bit of pep in your step. We've talked a lot of politics, but, you know, let me say this. Everything is not political because there is just so much great in the world, despite the cloud that is the division, despite the cloud that is, you know, in my case, sitting here in Alberta, that is the pandemic response. There is still hope. There is still light, and there is still tremendous work being done. And I am just so thrilled to talk about a not just the folklore, but beyond the folklore of Terry Fox and his legacy. Because for the 40th year, the Terry Fox Foundation, the Terry Fox Foundation is continuing the Terry Fox run. COVID, of course, impacting it. But this is an organization that has reached millions upon millions of Canadians, has funded some groundbreaking initiatives, raised several hundred million dollars. And it is my absolute pleasure to bring Fred Fox, brother of Terry Fox, onto the show to talk about this a bit more. Fred, how are you?
I'm great, Zane. How are you?
I am doing so well. You know, in preparation for this conversation with you, I was just looking up some of the notes in terms of the legacy of you know, not just your brother and what he meant to so many people in terms of inspiration, the icon that he represents to so many, but also the tremendous work of the foundation. And, you know, when you think about it, take stock of it. In these 40 years, what do you think about, or what kind of sticks out, you know, 40 years going for you?
Yeah, you're right. And it's definitely, you know, after 40, 41 years, it's definitely the impact of what Terry did in 1980. And he wanted to, it was his goal to impact lives, impact cancer research, and you know, supporting our researchers, some of the best researchers in the world across Canada, and so impacting lives through cancer research, and we've seen that, and with the monies that have been raised every year through the Terry Fox runs, whether in communities like it's going to happen this weekend, or in schools, you know, during the month of September, money has been raised, and you know, a cancer diagnosis is different than it was 10, 20, 40 years ago.
You know, when I'll jump into the event, but I want to tell you a quick story personally, if I can. You know, I grew up in the northeast part of Calgary, which was a very, you know, racialized, diverse part of the city. A lot of folks, like my family's background, incredibly poor, not with much means, but making our way in Canada as an immigrant family. And I remember vividly that there was a school in our community, Terry Fox in Northeast Calgary, Terry Fox Junior High. And we had designated schools that we had to go to, but there was a constellation of us, and not a small one, like not a small group of us, that wanted to go to Terry Fox. It wasn't our designated school. We wanted to go there because we learned about Terry Fox. We were inspired by him. We just loved reading the story and the vision, the not even just the folklore, but the man. And it was the primary reason. As soon as we knew it was going to be named Terry Fox Junior High, we wanted to go to that school. And I thought I'd just share that with you, because I suspect you have over the years heard hundreds, if not thousands, of stories like that, you know, that have perhaps been formally and in this case, very formally and directly related to the legacy of your brother.
You bet. And I've been to Terry Fox Junior High in Calgary there.
You have,
a few
yes.
years back. Yeah. And you know, sharing Terry's story, and it's amazing. And you know, there's 14 schools across Canada with Terry's name on it. And
it's incredible.
In fact, the high school that we went to in Port Coquitlam, Port Coquitlam Senior High, was renamed Terry Fox. And I'm in that school often throughout the school year, watching basketball games and whatnot, and you know, Terry's inspiration is there every day. So it's amazing, whether it's climbing Mount Terry Fox in Valemont, BC, or whatever it is, you know, people are inspired by Terry. So it's kind of your story is means a lot to hear that, because I hear it from people when I travel across Canada. People will share, their connection to Terry, that they saw, their mom, and they went screaming and yelling as their mom and dad yeah. dragged them when they were 6 years old out to the highway to see Terry run by in 1980, but are so proud and happy that that happened, because it's impacted their lives today.
Fred, tell me about the event. I want to leave enough time for you to, tell me about the 41st annual run. It's going forward. It's virtual this year. I suspect COVID has been a struggle from many perspectives, but powering through and happening this Sunday. So tell me a bit more about the event across the country.
Yeah, like last year, the 2020 year 40th anniversary, we went to virtual. We're virtual again this year, but as Canadians are, very resilient. The example of Terry Fox is Terry met every challenge head on. Canadians do the same thing, and especially Terry Foxers, people who participate every year. COVID isn't going to stop them. Cancer hasn't stopped. There's still a need to fundraise for cancer research. So, it is virtual. So we're asking everybody to, not gather at their normal spot, whether it's in a park or rec center, whatever they do in their community, but go online. Go to the Terry Fox website, Terry Fox Foundation website, terryfox.org, register, make a donation, fundraise, create your own fundraising page, but still go out and participate. Walk, run, ride from your front door, go to the local park, but do it with your family, friends, your bubble, whatever it is, and still important to get out there and participate. And Canadians did that last year. We know they're going to do it again this year.
I was going to ask you how last year went. I suspect you got good participation and hoping for the same this year, right?
Yeah, I think very proud of how the Terry Fox Foundation last year, stepped up in their social media platforms and kept people engaged. And that's what we saw last year. People on the day of, one day their way, doing their Terry Fox events in a different way. The social media engagement was amazing, and it'll happen this year. The fundraising on the community side was outstanding last year because, again, that resiliency of Canadians wanted, have supported Terry Fox for so many years and wanted that to continue.
Fred Fox, brother of Terry Fox, the Terry Fox Foundation will go ahead with their 41st annual Terry Fox Run for Cancer Research. It's online on September 19th. Fred, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you so much for keeping the legacy alive and helping millions of people with this important cancer research.
Well, thank you, and thank you for Canadians for keeping this alive. It's without them, it wouldn't be happening for sure.
Thanks, Fred. That almost does it for me here, folks. If you want to listen to any part of today's show, download and subscribe to the Evan Solomon Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network for further programming. Evan will be back in the chair on Monday. Big, big night. We'll also be back with the War Room panel. I'll also be taking my seat back on the War Room panel. Evan will be cracking open his dad jokes book, as I expect he will reveal several more gems from that. But this is all for me, Zane Velji, filling in for Evan Solomon on the iHeartRadio Talk Network. Keep listening. Evan is back on Monday.